4. The crossing of the return threshold. The two worlds, the divine and the human, can be pictured only as distinct from each other, different as life and death, as day and night. The hero adventures out of the land we know into darkness, there accomplishes his adventure, or again is simply lost to us, imprisoned, or in danger. And his return is described as a coming back out of that yonder zone. Nevertheless, and here is a great key to the understanding of myth and symbol, the two kingdoms are actually one. The realm of the gods is a forgotten dimension of the world we know, and the exploration of that dimension, either willingly or unwillingly, is the whole sense of the deed of the hero. The values and distinctions that in normal life seem important disappear with the terrifying assimilation of the self into what formerly was only otherness. As in the stories of the cannibal ogresses, the fearfulness of this loss of personal individuation can be the whole burden of the transcendental experience for unqualified souls. But the hero soul goes boldly in, and discovers the hags converted into goddesses, and the dragons into the watchdogs of the gods. There must always remain, however, from the standpoint of normal waking consciousness, a certain baffling inconsistency between the wisdom brought forth from the deep and the prudence usually found to be effective in the light world. Hence the common divorce of opportunism from virtue, and the resultant degeneration of human existence. Martyrdom is for saints, but the common people have their institutions, and these cannot be left to grow like lilies of the field. Peter keeps drawing his sword, as in the garden, to defend the creator and sustainer of the world. The boon brought from the transcendent deep becomes quickly rationalized into non-entity, and the need becomes great for another hero to refresh the word. How teach again, however, what has been taught correctly and incorrectly learned 1,000 times throughout the millennia of mankind's prudent folly? That is the hero's ultimate difficult task. How render back into light world language the speech-defying pronouncements of the dark? How represent on a two-dimensional surface a three-dimensional form, or in a three-dimensional image, a multi-dimensional meaning? How translate into terms of yes and no, revelations that shatter into meaninglessness every attempt to define the pairs of opposites? How communicate to people who insist on the exclusive evidence of their senses the message of the all-generating void? Many failures attest to the difficulties of this life-affirmative threshold. The first problem of the returning hero is to accept as real, after an experience of the soul-satisfying vision of fulfillment, the passing joys and sorrows, banalities, and noisy obscenities of life. Why re-enter such a world? Why attempt to make plausible or even interesting to men and women consumed with passion the experience of transcendental bliss? As dreams that were momentous by night may seem simply silly in the light of day, so the poet and the prophet can discover themselves playing the idiot before a jury of sober eyes. The easy thing is to commit the whole community to the devil and retire again into the heavenly rock dwelling, close the door, and make it fast. But if some spiritual obstetrician has meanwhile drawn the Shimanawa across the retreat, then the work of representing eternity in time and perceiving in time eternity cannot be avoided. The story of Rip Van Winkle is an example of the delicate case of the returning hero. Rip moved into the adventurous realm unconsciously, as we all do every night when we go to sleep. In deep sleep, declare the Hindus, the self is unified and blissful. Therefore, deep sleep is called the cognitional state. But though we are refreshed and sustained by these nightly visits to the source darkness, our lives are not reformed by them. We return, like Rip, with nothing to show for the experience but our whiskers.
He looked round for his gun, but in place of the clean, well-oiled fowling piece, he found an old firelock lying by him, the barrel encrusted with rust, the lock falling off, and the stock worm-eaten. As he rose to walk, he found himself stiff in the joints, and wanting his usual activity. As he approached the village, he met a number of people, but none whom he knew, which somewhat surprised him, for he had thought himself acquainted with everyone in the country round. Their dress, too, was of a different fashion from that to which he was accustomed. They all stared at him with equal marks of surprise, and, whenever they cast their eyes upon him, invariably stroked their chins. The constant recurrence of this gesture induced Rip involuntarily to do the same, when, to his astonishment, he found his beard had grown a foot long. He began to doubt whether both he and the world around him were not bewitched. The appearance of Rip, with his long grizzled beard, his rusty fowling piece, his uncouth dress, and the army of women and children that had gathered at his heels, soon attracted the attention of the tavern politicians. They crowded round him, eyeing him from head to foot with great curiosity. The orator bustled up to him, and, drawing him partly aside, inquired on which side he voted. Rip stared in vacant stupidity. Another short but busy little fellow pulled him by the arm, and, rising on tiptoe, inquired in his ear whether he was a federal or a Democrat. Rip was equally at a loss to comprehend the question, when a knowing, self-important old gentleman in a sharp cocked hat made his way through the crowd, putting them to the right and left with his elbows as he passed, and, planting himself before Van Winkle, with one arm akimbo, the other resting on his cane, his keen eyes and sharp hat penetrating, as it were, into his very soul, demanded in an austere tone what brought him to the election with a gun on his shoulder and a mob at his heels, and whether he meant to breed a riot in the village. "Alas, gentlemen," cried Rip, somewhat dismayed, "I am a poor, quiet man, a native of the place, and a loyal subject to the king, God bless him." Here a general shout burst from the bystanders. "A Tory! A Tory! A spy! A refugee! Hustle him! Away with him!" It was with great difficulty that the self-important man in the cocked hat restored order.
More dispiriting than the fate of Rip is the account of what happened to the Irish hero Oisin when he returned from a long sojourn with the daughter of the king of the land of youth. Oisin had done better than poor Rip. He had kept his eyes open in the adventurous realm. He had descended consciously, awake, into the kingdom of the unconscious, deep sleep, and had incorporated the values of the subliminal experience into his waking personality. A transmutation had been effected. But precisely because of this highly desirable circumstance, the dangers of his return were the greater. Since his entire personality had been brought into accord with the powers and forms of timelessness, all of him stood to be refuted, blasted by the impact of the forms and powers of time.
The Fenians were the men of Finn MacCool, giants all. Oisin, who was the son of Finn MacCool, had been one of their number. But their day now had long passed, and the inhabitants of the land were no longer the great ones of old. Such legends of archaic giants are common to folk traditions everywhere. See, for instance, the myth recounted above of King Muchukunda. Comparable are the protracted lives of the Hebrew patriarchs. Adam lived 930 years, Seth 912, Enos 905, etc., etc.
Oisin, the son of Finn MacCool, one day was out hunting with his men in the woods of Erin when he was approached by the daughter of the king of the land of youth. Oisin's men had gone ahead with the day's kill, leaving their master with his three dogs to shift for himself. And the mysterious being had appeared to him with the beautiful body of a woman, but the head of a pig. She declared that the head was due to a druidic spell, promising that it would vanish the very minute he would marry her. "Well, if that is the state you are in," said he, "and if marriage with me will free you from the spell, I'll not leave the pig's head on you long." Without delay, the pig's head was dispatched, and they set out together for Tir na Og, the land of youth. Oisin dwelt there as a king many happy years. But one day he turned and declared to his supernatural bride,
"I wish I could be in Erin today to see my father and his men." "If you go," said his wife, "and set foot on the land of Erin, you'll never come back here to me, and you'll become a blind old man. How long do you think it is since you came here?" "About 3 years," said Oisin. "It is 300 years," said she, "since you came to this kingdom with me. If you must go to Erin, I'll give you this white steed to carry you. But if you come down from the steed, or touch the soil of Erin with your foot, the steed will come back that minute, and you'll be where he left you, a poor old man." "I'll come back, never fear," said Oisin. "Have I not good reason to come back? But I must see my father and my son and my friends in Erin once more. I must have even one look at them." She prepared the steed for Oisin and said, "This steed will carry you wherever you wish to go." Oisin never stopped till the steed touched the soil of Erin, and he went on till he came to Knockpatrick in Munster, where he saw a man herding cows. In the field where the cows were grazing, there was a broad, flat stone. "Will you come here," said Oisin to the herdsman, "and turn over this stone?" "Indeed, then I will not," said the herdsman, "for I could not lift it, nor 20 men more like me." Oisin rode up to the stone, and reaching down, caught it with his hand and turned it over. Underneath the stone was the great horn of the Fenians, Borabu, which circled round like a seashell. And it was the rule that when any of the Fenians of Erin blew the Borabu, the others would assemble at once from whatever part of the country they might be in at the time. "Will you bring this horn to me?" asked Oisin of the herdsman. "I will not," said the herdsman, "for neither I nor many more like me could raise it from the ground." With that, Oisin moved near the horn, and reaching down took it in his hand. But so eager was he to blow it that he forgot everything, and slipped in reaching, till 1 foot touched the earth. In an instant the steed was gone, and Oisin lay on the ground a blind old man.
The equating of a single year in paradise to 100 of earthly existence is a motif well known to myth. The full round of 100 signifies totality. Similarly, the 360 degrees of the circle signify totality. Accordingly, the Hindu Puranas represent 1 year of the gods as equal to 360 of men. From the standpoint of the Olympians, eon after eon of earthly history rolls by, revealing ever the harmonious form of the total round, so that where men see only change and death, the blessed behold immutable form, world without end. But now the problem is to maintain this cosmic standpoint in the face of an immediate earthly pain or joy.